Yes, please, yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for expanding my understanding of Donna as a ground of being in a way that I have not truly understood, so which all else can ensue and be based upon. And then you mentioned the word love, and really coming from that as also a ground of being. And that's something I've certainly looked at and resonated. I have a question, though, and it's partly because of my naivete of the teachings and lack of familiarity with, with many suttas. But did the Buddha talk specifically about love?
He talked about the unconditioned, the unborn, the uncreated, and the unoriginated. And he said, because there is the unborn, the uncreated, and the unoriginated, there is an escape from the born, the created, and the originated. That was the language that he used. My deepest understanding about what love is not separate from what the Buddha is talking about. He didn't use the word love in that context.
Thank you. I had my suspicions, and the words that you spoke were ones I have heard, and it gives me a lot of good people.
Okay.
So much.
Yes.
I want to thank you very much because when I came in here, I was suffering a great deal of pain, physically and emotionally. And now only all I've got left is the physical.
And isn't that a relief?
Then I thank you very much.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to leave.
Okay.
But I'll take you with me.
Okay.
Thank you.
I understand bodhicitta to be the awakened mind, okay?
But compassion also.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. So the compassionate component of the awakened mind is what the bodhicitta is, yeah? My experience is that when one has a direct understanding of the nature of reality, then it is impossible that compassion is not the natural response. And to the degree that one has a direct understanding of the nature of the reality, in my opinion or understanding or sense, is the degree to which compassion is the natural response that comes as a result.
I ask because I think in our culture, people mistake compassion and love.
Yes.
And they aren't the same thing, but they are related.
Yes.
And so I think it's important to discern
yes.
the difference between and,
yes.
And still recognize the similarities between them.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you for your question. Yeah.
appreciate that you brought up this idea of the good karma book. And this summer, and that you mentioned the heat, I think the heat has it's really beating me up, and I'm kind of cumulative, getting to a cumulative level. And I think that's been part of some of the suffering that I've been experiencing for about a month and a half, related to some personal things. And it just was so amazing to me after a fair number of years of practice to just go to such a dark, closed place. And so hearing you talk about remembering your goodness, your good deeds, I kind of had an intuitive notion, and I was trying to do that, but it was so dark. And but anyway, I appreciated your words and your thoughts on that.
I think, I don't know about you, but I had this kind of strange idea that when we start practicing, there's a linear progression of greater, lighter, higher, blisser, happier, until we realize the final, complete, total, happy, blissed out thing. Yeah? And the reality is that it actually doesn't quite match up like that. And sometimes what happens is that a person needs many, many, many years of practice until they have the capacity to open up to things which are quite difficult. That can be the case with trauma. That can be the case with all kinds of stuff, or emotional patterns that one is not aware of. And so, ironically, even though it is not necessarily the case, sometimes when one finally has enough ground in one's practice, then one has the ability to open up to things which are actually quite dark. And dark. And that's actually a sign of deepening of practice rather than of regress and going backwards. Yeah. And so that's why sometimes it is really helpful having people around who know you or who know practice well, because what we can judge as backwards or falling away actually can be depth and taking quite a lot more capacity to enter.
I resonate with those words, and I know that several months ago I set out kind of a goal within myself that I wanted to deepen my understanding of suffering. And I thought that was going to be more of an external thing. I noticed that it became very personal, and I did begin to understand it more, and how it did make me more joined with the oneness and people, and brought more compassion ultimately.
Yeah. Because there's a monk that I know who's an excellent monk, and he's very, very, very popular. But it's almost as if his heart has never broken, and I don't trust him. You know, it's almost as if he hasn't. There's some qualities, the way he lives his life is as if he hasn't actually touched suffering in a particular way. And so I'm cautious. You know, it's not that I dismiss what he has to say, but I listen to it with a reservation. When somebody really understands suffering, that is something that I trust. You know, you can't fake it. You know, you just can't fake it. And so it can be transformed into tremendous potential gift. Understanding. Catherine?
It's a practice question, but thinking of how the other day I had the opportunity to just respond and give a gift. And one of the things that sort of means for me is not just appreciating it as a thought, but looking in the body, like pausing to notice what's the experience of it. Mm-hmm. Which, so it's a new thing for me to not have it. Meditation sometimes feels so mental. pay attention to here and pay attention instead of just sort of opening up to the field of experience.
Yeah. I think it's metta because we have very active minds. I think when meditation is alive, it's actually a very strong felt sense rather than a mental faculty. Yeah? But there's a story which is really a beautiful story. You know, there's a monk at Chitthurst, his father committed suicide, and he was the one who found his father. Okay? So it was a totally traumatic experience. And so every time he thought of his father, he'd go into kind of a trauma response. And then he decided that what he wanted to do was to shift that out of his system. So he determined that he was going to deliberately think of things to make people happy, to do kind things for people, okay? So in a monastery, you can wash people's socks and you can, I mean, there's a million things when you live in a community with people, what you can do to help them out. So he would pre-meditate thinking how to make a person happy. And then he would set it up so that he would be there when he saw their face, when they recognized that it had been set up deliberately to help them. Okay? And every time he did that, he'd say, "That's for you, Dad." Okay? So it didn't take too long. A few months. And rather than the name or the experience or the memory of his father putting him into this dark depression and trauma response, it put him into this ebullient well-being of the joy of making other people happy, the joy of giving. Actually, it's brilliant. Sharing of merit. Yeah.
Well, as opposed to just taking in the bed, you know, in doing such in a way that's only in my own mind and body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's more material.
Yeah.
Do it.
Making it happen.
More real.
Yeah. The way we need to penetrate or be with, and allow ourselves to suffer, mm-hmm.
and to recognize it,
mm-hmm.
and to be with it all the way through, and to say, yeah, this is how it is. And I find that in myself, and probably others do, that we do ourselves a disservice. We don't allow ourselves to be there. We're too, we're just running away all the time, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as soon as there's a taste, then it's conditioned. And we can kid ourselves, thinking that we're doing it, or that we're being what is and we're not.
That's right. Yeah. And so there's a kind of a deep sense of fearlessness and joyfulness that comes when one is able to meet suffering and not flinch into patterns of reactivity, of habit, of comforting or avoiding or denying or rejecting. Because when one is able to meet it and then come back to the place of, well, the problem isn't it, but the not wanting it, then something opens up. And that opening then brings a confidence in the practice, that we aren't going to continue to be able to do that with the things that emerge. And as that confidence in the practice gets stronger, fear falls away. So I have no idea what's going to happen in the future, you know, and I have no idea the kind of physical circumstances or emotional circumstances that I'm going to be confronted with. But I have absolute confidence in the practice. Yes.
Why is it that you're not allowed to receive money?
In the forest tradition, which there are different traditions and different people have different takes on it, but it was established by the Buddha when he created the monastic order, that he wanted monks and nuns to live in an interdependent relationship with the lay community. And in order, what he established was is that the monks and nuns wouldn't handle money, because if you handle money, then you can buy things. And if you can buy things, then you don't need people to help you to do things or to get things or to offer things. So he made it as clear as possible that we're not to be self-sufficient in terms of growing food or storing food or keeping food or having funds that then we can have access to, that required then that we live in an interdependent relationship with the lay community. It forced that. And part of the reason why that forced that was because he felt if monks and nuns are practicing in a good way, they are an example, both in terms of their life of dedication, of simplicity, of renunciation, and of morality, as well as their meditation practice. If they are an example, then they will be of benefit to the lay community. But if they don't have to have contact with the lay community, then the lay community doesn't have the benefit of their example. So it was created a situation that was practical because it created a way in which the monks and nuns would be able to be supported. But it was also created in a way where the maximum benefit to the lay community would be ensured, because every single day food needs to be offered in order to be eaten, you know. And so it requires a contact. And so even if people are on retreat and they're not speaking, you know, there's not a whole lot of discourse and there's not a lot of communication, it's still a thing to come to a monastery and feel the effect of what it is with people living in that way and practicing in that way and offering food. And that effect will have a rippling effect on the community. The other reason, I think, is that when it's done this way, it's like on some level you don't need to have a central organizing committee about what's happening with the monks and the nuns, because if the monks and the nuns are not living a life which is inspiring and encouraging and offering an example which is worthy of respect, then people aren't interested, they don't come, they don't bring food, they don't bring offerings, and monks and nuns don't live. It's like you don't, it's not a centrally organized system, it's a immediate direct feedback mechanism. That if what we're doing is not worthy of support, we won't be supported. It's like, you don't need to have a big discussion. Yeah.
I have a follow-up question. So now you've moved to Colorado Springs.
Right.
How do lay people support you? It seems like there isn't that as much of that direct contact.
Well, I'm just starting. And so there's an organization that was created because people were inspired by the interest to support monastics and wanting this to happen and hoping that this does flourish. So they've created an organization that I'm teaching, and people are hopefully learning that I need to eat food and are going to be able to recognize that if they bring food or offer food, that that's a good thing. And so there's a combination of an educational process of me being around more people and just teaching and having people having a sense of the kind of teachings that come through and whether they feel resonant or not. But also beginning to get their mind wrapped around the idea of, well, what is a monastic community for, you know? Because oftentimes people think, well, you know, I like the lay teacher, I don't like the lay teacher, it's my style, it's not my style, I like it, I don't like it, you know. You know, I like it a little bit more like that, you know. And what a monastic community is about is creating an opportunity of people who are willing and interested to completely dedicate their lives to realizing the truth, living with renunciation and simplicity and integrity. And the process of doing that is actually something which brings blessings and benefit to people who are participating and supporting it. Now, when there is a community of monastics, that creates a foundation that the lay community is going to be really well supported. But it's a time investment because it takes years and sometimes it takes decades. Yeah. So rather than thinking, well, you know, I'll do this and what can I get, you know, immediately. It's like, well, I'll do, it's like, you know, you put an oak seed in the ground and after 10 years, 20 years, you have a tree. After 40 years, 50 years, it can handle an elephant. After 100 years, 150 years, you've got this whole ecosystem. Well, something is similar with monastics, you know. So part of the education is changing or beginning to see that when one is supporting a monastic community, one's creating a field of blessings that is completely different than when one is just relating with an individual teacher. Yeah. And you have to begin to feel the field of blessings in order to get a sense of what that is. A monastery is an open place where anyone is welcome to come. Anybody comes. People from all kinds of religions come. People from all kinds of cultures and backgrounds, all kinds of diversity. People are there and they're welcome. And if you don't know the politics, you know, you'll see people who are at this video tomorrow who in their own countries are at war with each other. But here they come, rejoicing in the opportunity of giving to the monastery. So the monastery is like this neutral zone where everyone is welcome. And people are welcome to come. They don't have to pay. They don't have to be Buddhist. They don't have to believe. All that's needed is they're willing to participate in the routine of the day and keep the precepts if they're staying overnight. So this field of blessing is created that everyone can participate in, and no one is required to pay for it. And so it's a different kind of thinking than the normal thinking of, well, who's doing good retreats? Or, you know, what can I, what, you know, who do I want to sit with? Or, you know, who are my group? Yeah? And, you know, in our community, you have some people who are good with children and some people who are good with older people and some people who are good with disability people and some people who are good with, I mean, there's just a tremendous variety of resource. So it's a different model that isn't the model that Western Buddhists have grown up with. But it's like there are a few people who are interested in living this life and wanting to see if some kind of enough ground can emerge that will make it possible for others who are also interested in drawing near. Now, for myself, I feel that the traditional monastic model has an enormous amount to offer in certain areas, and in other areas, it needs to be questioned. So the model that the monks and the nuns have the knowledge, the experience, and the wisdom, and the lay people are the ones that offer the requisites and the resources, doesn't work when you're working with lay people whose lives are dedicated to the Dhamma, who've been practicing for 20, 30, 40 years, who are teachers themselves, okay? It doesn't work. And so I'm interested in evolving a monastic model that allows some of these rigid definitions or structured traditional definitions to start to support the awakening for everyone in a way which is alive and vital. I'm interested in that. Because I get a lot from my friendships with very profound practitioners. And, you know, their precept form is not the determination of how much I get out. It's their commitment to practice, the depth of their realization and the depth of our friendship. And I think it's important to begin to acknowledge that and find forms and structures which allow that to emerge. rather than the monks and the nuns only the ones giving talks, and, you know, the lay people only the ones offering the dana. Now, as a nun, I'm not going to be the one who's going to be able to offer material requisites, yeah? But the way in which I give my life in terms of service is something that I can make possible that people who are working full-time cannot, you know? So today, you know, hanging out in the park for a couple hours just to see if people were interested to come and talk to me one-on-one. You know, when people have full-time lives and full-time families and full-time jobs and full-time everything, it's hard to create space to do stuff like that. Whereas for me, it's that would be an obvious and natural thing and joyful thing to do. Yeah. So I feel the monastic model has an enormous amount to offer, and yet there are certain traditional elements that need to be preserved and certain ones that need to be explored and expanded and opened up. And how this is going to work, I mean, there's lots of things that can happen for people on a web. So there's, I've got talks and stuff and things need to be transcribed. So there's all kinds of things that can happen at a distance. It can happen through people inviting me here to teach. It can happen through organizing things there from telephones and internet here. I mean, what do you think? I don't know. But that's what I mean, I think that there'll be ways that it can happen. So. It's 8:35 now. Do we need to finish? Yeah. So I just want to close with expressions of appreciation for your interest, your attention, your practice. You're coming here tonight in the heat. And may your practice flourish and bring fruit that allows you to understand suffering and the end of suffering and the compassion that is the what's left when everything falls away.